is Bird Note. Singing from atop a cactus, a handsome bird greets the new day. It's a black-throated sparrow, an iconic desert denizen of the southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico. A patch of pure black accents their throats, and white stripes boldly mark their dark faces. Black-throated sparrows thrive in open, arid habitats, with evenly spaced shrubs, trees, and cacti. These bushy plants provide the perfect perch for the male's serenade and shelter for the female to build her cup-shaped nest. The sparrows can also be found on the ground, foraging for seeds and insects. Historically, these native ecosystems were naturally maintained with frequent low-intensity fires. But decades of drought and fire suppression have set the stage for hotter, more destructive blazes. We can protect this vibrant desert habitat by preventing overgrazing on rangelands, combating the spread of invasive plants, and restoring a sustainable fire regime to the landscape. Each of these measures would help sustain the black-throated sparrow's gentle song. For Bird Note.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
We are fueled by your support. You make CJSF.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here this evening with Hale and Brendan. I wanted to talk today about a concept that I've been researching and thinking about, a phenomenon called corporatocracy. I think it's relevant. There seems to be a trend toward corporatocracy in government, everywhere from federal to provincial to state and municipal levels in various parts of the world. So I've been researching it and wanted to explore a little bit with the two of you about what it means and maybe go over some examples of it close to home. Corporatocracy on a municipal level. And I'm going to read here just from a Google AI search. It refers to a system where local city governments run like private businesses or where corporate interests heavily control public municipal decisions. It blends public administration with profit-driven market rules. And today I want to be most focused on municipal corporatocracy, although the same thing would hold in an analogous way at a provincial or a state or a federal level.
Yeah, I think it's really an interesting thing to focus in on corporatocracy at a local level, because we tend to think of these sort of international conglomerates as influencing things on a very global scale. But obviously that filters down and has a real prescient effect on local communities, businesses, and, you know, also, you know, local governments and stuff like that, that, you know, people don't even realize. And it kind of all strings together from, you know, from the little guy all the way to the big guy who's, you know, usually on his yacht somewhere.
Yeah. And this response I got goes on to say that corporate developers and business groups have a strong say in local laws, zoning, and tax policies. What are the concerns? Well, it also says here local governments set up separate corporate entities to handle public utilities, transit, or development to bypass standard bureaucratic rules. Cities use private sector management models, performance metrics, and cost efficiency goals instead of traditional public service paths. So what are some of the negative effects? One would be reduced democracy. So public input matters less when decisions are made by appointed corporate boards rather than elected officials. Then there's the problem of profit over people. Essential services may focus on making money or charging user fees rather than helping low-income residents. Then there's the problem of less transparency. Corporate structures hide financial choices behind privacy rules that do not apply to regular public offices.
Yeah, I think what we really see is just the influence of big business on local government. Like, I like how you brought up the idea of democracy, right? Like that, like at its bare bones, democracy is, you know, government by the people, and ideally, it's, you know, each individual citizen has is you know, their one citizen. It's one person, one citizen, one vote. But that's obviously not how this system works. And a corporatocracy is clearly when whatever sort of governmental system you had prior has been warped to be primarily influenced by business interests, right? And the system is always, that system is always going to prioritize the bottom line, you know, the financial bottom line, right? So, you know, governments effectively become both local and, you know, a larger scale, kind of become corporate puppets, and citizens really become consumers. And problems and crises really just become opportunities for business interests to make money in one way or another, right? It's, you know, no longer for the benefit of the people. It's for the benefit of whatever business interests are most involved.
I think we can say that one way of viewing corporatocracy is that it's sort of a marriage between government and private business. And the two of those entities, right, governments and private businesses, they seem to have common interests in raising money. And in the case of the private companies, it's profit. And in the case of the government, they seem to believe they can solve, the government can solve its financial woes by these alignments, these marriages with private companies. The question is that democracy, and do the people, the citizens for whom the government is supposed to be operating and answering to in a democracy, are the citizens really winning out? I think that's the problem here. And we can get into more specific examples in a while, right here at home. So I've been involved in some of the politics and the doings and the machinations of the municipal government in Vancouver. And I have something to say about what's been going on in Vancouver in relation to this concept of corporatocracy. But I wanted to mention a couple other related terms that sometimes are associated with or could get confused with corporatocracy. And one term is corporatism. And corporatism is not the same thing as corporatocracy. And again, an AI response here on Google, which I'm actually starting to really appreciate the AI responses, because it's a quick way of getting meaningful information, although we have to always be skeptical and wary of mistakes that do happen and research what's behind the AI. But I think in this case, it gives us a pretty good idea when it says that corporatism is a political and economic system that organizes society into industrial, professional, and vocational groups, such as labor unions and business associations, that negotiate policy or exercise state-sanctioned control. It does not mean rule by big business enterprises, which is instead called corporatocracy. So I think corporatism can be distinguished from corporatocracy, and that corporatism is a model that political and that political institutions and governments can use. They can sort of organize themselves in a corporate fashion, in a corporate structure. And that's a different thing than the marriage between government and private business. So in the case of corporatism, the government sort of emulates private business, but with corporatocracy, the government actually aligns itself and associates with and marries itself to private business.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction to make between the two. You know, right off the top of my head, another kind of distinction, or frankly, a subgenre of corporatocracy that's become quite in vogue these days, is the idea by the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis of techno-feudalism, which is, I think, closely aligned with corporatocracy in the idea that there's particular tech companies which are the primary economic, you know, kind of power overlords, which sort of rent out spaces of public discourse and public market that function more like feudal systems. And so in this way, this is, while it's a sub kind of slightly unrelated or slightly disrelated to corporatocracy, it is a kind of a sub part of it, in the sense that these tech companies, big tech companies, tend to be very closely aligned with and heavily influence both, you know, federal and municipal governments.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to bring in that idea of techno-feudalism and kind of trying it to square it with this idea of corporatocracy, because techno-feudalism is, I like the analogy that you kind of, or the metaphor you're using of like a subgenre. It's like a particular facet or manifestation of it, especially in the tech sphere, when so much of what our economy and just our society in general relies on becomes wedded to technology and the internet. I'm thinking especially of social media, what Hale calls now present media, to just basically be the vehicle for mass social communication, even informing yourself about things. Most people learn about news, they get their news from social media, and insofar as those tech platforms are a corporate entity, they have the capacity to be agents in the corporatocracy to legislate and to influence and lobby.
Yeah, within the context of corporatocracy as well, in my own kind of reading on the topic, one of the big things that actually came up was media and media control, right? And this sort of, again, this sort of marriage of, as Mikey said, of big business and, you know, public communication and public power. You know, media obviously plays a huge role in that. You know, the old adage is, you know, knowledge is power. And if, you know, whoever controls the flow of that knowledge, then, you know, kind of has the ultimate weapon at their disposal. And it's really interesting to look into, you know, who controls what media. So, like, earlier, Mikey brought up some kind of local issues, and I was also thinking about this in terms of the media sphere, and I actually looked into specific, if we're going to get into some specific examples, I looked into, for Vancouver, two of the primary, you know, kind of news and media outlets, both on TV and online, which are both CTV and Global News in Vancouver. If you're in Vancouver, these are two of the primary news networks that you're going to be kind of watching or looking up online or hearing on the radio. And I kind of looked into who owns these. And so, for example, CTV is owned by BCE, which is Bell Canadian Enterprises Company. The same company owns BNN Bloomberg, TSN, USA Network, Much Music, Crave, and has HBO rights. And on top of that, has 109 licensed radio stations across Canada. So that's all one media entity that's sort of controlling and having a say in public discourse, right? What we're discussing. And then Global, the other big one, if you're going to be in Vancouver, is owned by Corus Entertainment, which is their parent company, which owns specifically 15 global channels across Canada, as well as the Home Network, Showcase, Slice. And most interestingly, I thought they own Teletoon, Treehouse, YTV, and Kids Can Press. That's Kids Canadian Press. So they own a whole bunch of youth and young persons media outlets. So again, and specifically Corus Entertainment is partnered with Disney and Paramount and Warner Brothers. So again, you kind of look at these and you see your local global channel and you think, oh, they're talking about Vancouver issues, they've got Vancouver in mind, when in reality you kind of follow the breadcrumbs and it goes all the way back to companies like Disney. Right? That's where, like, that blending starts to happen, right? Between your kind of your local society and these very large, you know, international conglomerates having influence on your, you know, apparent kind of local city.
I wanted to bring up a third concept to throw in the mix, which is the concept of privatization. So we've talked a little bit about corporatocracy, about corporatism, and now privatization. I think they're all related and they overlap. They sort of go hand in hand. I'm actually looking at a story. It's about 10 years old from the Cato Institute, which appears to be a fairly conservative institute. And they wrote a story about privatization, which seems to be quite in favor, quite favorable toward the concept of privatization. But I wanted to read a couple excerpts so we can sort of understand what is meant by privatization. With respect to the American economy, the article says, the American economy is sluggish. The government is running large deficits and the public is frustrated with the poor performance of federal bureaucracies. One reform that can tackle all of these problems is privatizing federal businesses and assets. This study discusses a dozen advantages of privatization and describes government activities that should be moved to the private sector. So this is obviously a pretty far right view that more of the public sector needs to be transferred to the private sector. And this article argues that it's been quite successful. It says, for example, privatization would allow entrepreneurs to take on challenges at which federal bureaucracies are failing. The United States is a land of huge talent and diversity, but to take full advantage of those assets, we should divest the government of activities that individuals and businesses can perform better by themselves. Talking about Canada, it says during the 1980s and 1990s, Canada privatized more than 50 major businesses, including electric utilities, a railway, an airline, and the air traffic control system. France sold 22 major companies in 1986 and 1987.
Yeah, and I think a lot of with my own readings with corporatocracy, I actually have a few things to say on that point. But one of them is that especially from the research that I did from the 70s and 1980s and the 90s, there was this big push for a lot of governments to effectively take on debt, right? They took on lots of debt. And what ended up happening then is you had business to deal with that debt. You had large business interests, corporate interests, basically influencing and pressuring the government to sell off state assets, right? So he was talking about things like railroads and telecommunication and perhaps, you know, resource extraction, things that priorly had been owned by the state or had been government funded, were then being sold off to private interests, right? So that, you know, as a way to deal with the debt issue, which itself in many cases was encouraged by those same government interests, right? Through subsidies and stuff like that to big businesses and all that kind of thing. So you get this kind of cycle, right? Where, you know, where the money always flows back into big business pockets.
Well, one of the fallacies, I think, in the argument for privatization is that the deficiencies or the failures or the inadequacies of public sector operations, like let's take, like, say, the postal services, for an example, the reason that they're having trouble in many cases is that they've been starved of funds. So politicians and decision makers will starve public sector operations, whether it be like Canada Post or railways or ferries or whatever the case may be, transportation systems, medical systems, right? They'll be starved of funding. And so they underperform. And then the same politicians and decision makers who reduced funding or didn't provide adequate funding will then say, look, we're proven right. The Canada Post or BC Ferries or whoever it might be can't perform well as a public entity, so we need to privatize it. So it's sort of a disingenuous argument, I think, in many ways, that the public sector could perform much better if the public sector was given adequate resources. So privatization is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you move resources away from the public sector and then say, oh, look, the public sector isn't working right. So that justifies us moving resources away. It's circular, right?
Yeah, you know, I think it really is circular. And it's a process of chipping away, right?
Like a circular argument.
A lot of this stuff with corporatocracy has taken, you know, it's taken place over many decades, especially since the 1970s. And I think most academics would agree, particularly the 1980s with Reagan and Reaganomics, was a real, like, a launch pad for this. But it was a steady chipping away of this sort of social safety nets and, you know, government structures that have been in place, especially since the New Deal, and things that were replicated, you know, throughout the Commonwealth as well, like in countries like Canada, that was kind of chipped away. And so it always starts small. And like, I can even think of some local examples for, you know, in for Vancouver as well. You know, many of our listeners will be in Vancouver. You know, even in some of the parks in Vancouver, for example, they're starting to privatize some of the sports and leisure activities, right? So they're starting to turn them into basically pay for play services, right? So now you, instead of being able to, say, example, for, I live by, you know, Kitts Beach at Kitts Park, there's a number of tennis courts, and now they're opening what's called a pilot project. It always starts small, it always starts with something little, where now these tennis courts are no longer publicly accessible. You have to go through a third party to basically sign up to use them, and you have to pay for them. And, you know, and it's no longer just that you show up and play tennis. You have to go through this whole system. And guess what? There's another agency. There's a business involved in operating that and running that and enforcing all that, right? So not only is, you know, this sort of public service or this public activity being taken away from the community, but also there's a private business that is profiting off of that loss.
Right. So that's a great example of this overlap between these three phenomena that I've brought forward this evening, corporatism, corporatocracy, and privatization. So you have the public sector shrinking, resources being handed over to the private sector. So that's privatization. You have this marriage between the private sector and the government, with the government making decisions which seem to benefit its relationship with the private companies, but don't necessarily, and I would argue quite often, do not benefit or to the detriment of citizens. So I wanted to point out one other problem, one other argument against, I would say, most squarely this would be corporatism, when the government starts to act like a corporation. And this is an example in Vancouver. So I was president at a park board, Vancouver Park Board meeting about a year ago, where a debate ensued over whether the park board commissioner should hand over more power to the city government, which is sort of separate from the park board itself, to make large purchases, to do large procurements for large contracts, you know, for millions of dollars. And the city and some of the park board commissioners were arguing that in the name of efficiency, the elected park board, that's seven elected commissioners, ought to delegate more authority to the city to go ahead on its own volition without park board oversight to sign large contracts for either maintenance, or it was also true in the case of like a large logging operation that's been taking place in Stanley Park. The city wants to be able to enter into multi-million dollar contracts on its own volition without getting approval of the seven elected commissioners. And we have to note that by statute, right, it's actually provincial legislation, which is known as the Vancouver City Charter. The seven elected commissioners of the Vancouver Park Board have exclusive jurisdiction over the parks. So a few of the park board commissioners protested and they said, no, it might be more efficient to skip over us, to skip over the elected representatives when decisions had to be made. So maybe it's quicker and more efficient and more expedient for the city bureaucrats to be able to enter into contracts on their own without coming to us. But we are a entity, the Vancouver Park Board, which is not supposed to operate on principles of efficiency, but rather on principles of governance. We are charged with governing the parks to protect the parks and protect the interests of the citizens. Our primary goal should not be efficiency. And that's not to say that we want to be inefficient, they said, but our primary goal is not efficiency. And our primary goal is to be a democratically elected board that represents the interests of the people that voted for us and represents the interests of the parks that we were, you know, elected to oversee. So that really, I think, illustrates the distinction between running a government like a corporation in the sense of corporatism versus running a government.
I think that this is something that we're seeing governing more, body more frequently, like especially down south with the whole MAGA movement and Trump and all this kind of stuff, where there's a sort of like equivalence of, you know, government is a business, right? And I think what's getting lost is, you know, what are our principles? What are our primary principles? And what is the mandate of whatever government or government bodies are involved, right? Like, what is our purpose for being? Why are we here? And I think, Mikey, you pointed out, like, efficiency is something that comes up all the time. But efficiency is generally linked to, you know, getting stuff done quickly and usually linked, in that case, to profits, right? Like, how quickly can we get this job done and how much value can we extract during that process, right? And that's not really what something like the Parks, Vancouver Parks Board is for, as you said, right? It's for representation of, you know, the local community, for the protection of the parks. That's the mandate, right? Not just getting things done as cheaply as possible, or, you know, people making the most money as possible, or whatever it might be, right? But I think there's been this real loss and this sort of shift, this sort of ideological shift to know everything is kind of like a business, right? And it really reminds me of, you know, people like Mark Fisher and capitalist realism, where we can only sort of see things in this kind of box of like what's making the most money, what's making the most profit, right? That's the measure of success. And it's like, well, and that's how you end up in situations where it's like, well, then why do we even need parks, right? Parks aren't making a bunch of money. Why don't we just, like, you know, bulldoze this and build shopping centers or like luxury housing or whatever it's going to be, right? Like, if you take that logic to its full extension, then a lot of things that people really care about and are really personally involved in and have, you know, a lot of value in terms of, like, you know, their well-being and quality of life don't actually have a place in that kind of system.
One of the characteristics, as we've discussed, of corporatism and also corporatocracy is that essential services may focus on making money or charging user fees rather than helping low-income residents. That's how a corporation works, right? A corporation is trying to be efficient. It's trying to make money. I mean, corporations exist to make profit. And to the extent that our public services are privatized, are run like corporations or by corporations or in sync, in partnership with corporations. So we've just talked about, again, those three principles, privatization, corporatism, and corporatocracy. To the extent that those things are coming into play in our lives, including here in Vancouver, then one of the things we see is that efficiency takes priority over the good of the public, and low-income people certainly will probably be the first to suffer. So how is that manifesting? Well, the Vancouver Park Board just recently has been making dramatic exponential increases in parking fees at public facilities. The one that's gotten a lot of public attention has been the exponential rise in parking fees at Spanish Banks, which is a beach recreational area up at Point Grey, heavily used, beautiful beach. You can walk out in low tide, way out on the sand spit there. It's a very popular public resource. And about 3 years ago, parking was free there. It went up to $1, $2, and now the current park board has just raised it to $4.25 an hour. And there's a huge backlash. If you look at social media, a lot of people are very, very upset because that prices them out. If you want to go spend an afternoon at the beach, you want to spend 3 or 4 hours at the beach. Now it's going to cost you, you know, upwards of, you know, close to $20 or more. And so what it does is it favors people that are well off, that can have that kind of discretionary spending. And it discriminates against people who are less well off or who are poor. And that's a characteristic of the current municipal government and also the park board in Vancouver. It's this corporate mentality of efficiency.
Yeah, and I
raising
know that
money
I, like, personally
by, raising user fees.
Well, there's lots of recreational activities that I may not participate in, literally because parking is too expensive, right? Like, if I have to go somewhere and I know I'm going to go there for a few hours, I want to spend exactly like say the day at the beach, and I know it's going to cost me, you know, $30 or whatever to park there for the day, well, then there's a good chance I'm not going to do it. And I think, you know, I'm reminded of some other episodes that Brandon, I've done recently in terms of, you know, media control and narrative.